Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We do not yet have a quorum, but we are going to go ahead and get started on time. We will be having some testifiers from DHS coming in today, and I see that they are getting prepared at the rostrum. Before doing so, Representative Grunhagen, do you have something you would like to share?
I forgot, no. I guess I'd appreciate if a few more members were here.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, if you'd like to do that, we have the testifiers here ready to go. But you had asked for some time when we kicked off the meeting. It's time, so.
Okay. Well, I will share this information. You know, I was thinking over the weekend. Not that I don't think during the week, okay? But I was thinking over the weekend and about the testimony we had concerning Medicaid. And then I got a call from a client of mine. She's an elderly lady. She's over 65. And she's on a very tight budget financially. And she was complaining that under her Part D drug program, her co-pays were going up for some of the drugs that she was paying. And she was wondering how she was going to pay that additional copay. And during the course of the conversation, she brought up that her daughter is a nurse at one of our hospitals here in Minnesota, one of our major hospitals here in Minnesota. And one of her complaints was that they have people from foreign countries that come here and receive free surgeries paid for under Medicaid, according to what her daughters told her. And you know, when we had testimony last week about this, I asked whether there was a residency requirement to receive Medicaid benefits here in the state of Minnesota. And the answer was yes. Well, then I went up afterwards and questioned the testifier, what are those residency requirements? Well, you simply have to be in the state of Minnesota, tell that you're here, and you intend to stay here, period. That's the residency requirement. It's not 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days. It's, well, I'm here in Minnesota and I intend to stay here. Well, you could change your mind tomorrow, okay, and leave the state again. So the reason I'm sharing this is I thought of a few bills to bring forward, and I thought, you know, maybe it would be better if we addressed some of these concerns on a bipartisan basis. And tried to address some of these areas where some waste, fraud, and abuse are occurring. The other thing that concerned me about last week's testimony is I brought up the idea of somebody with $1 million in their IRA, and since there's no asset test, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, if they weren't drawing or drawing very little out of their IRA, they could qualify for medical assistance. This, by the way, was confirmed by a local social worker from my district when I met with them a few months ago. They claimed that people that are worth $2-3 million were qualifying for fuel assistance. Okay, and again, we all want to help the people that really need it, but I think the system needs some tightening up, especially those who can afford to pay their way and maybe taking advantage of the system. Okay, the other thing that was shared is that, you know, if you live with a man who fathered your children, it affects your welfare benefits. But if you live with a man who didn't father your children, it doesn't affect your benefits. And of course, it went on to say there's no on-site verification or very little on that. You know, I have another customer call me a few months ago, and they talked about one of their relatives who is living with a third guy and has children from about three or four different men. And when this particular dairy farmer's wife told her relative to get a job, she said, "Why should I work? If I have additional children, I get additional money." And this extremely frustrated my client, who called me up and says, "Can't something be done about this?" So, again, I'm sharing this to hopefully develop a bipartisan consensus on how we could address some of these things. the last thing, and I'm using a report by Inspector Jerry Kerber from February 2013, and he gives five examples of waste, fraud, and abuse on this memo, and I just happen to keep it. It entails about $2.5 million of taxpayer money, and one of the examples is $483 that was collected by a North Oaks couple that pleaded guilty to mail fraud, healthcare fraud, and theft of money. And they basically had moved up here from Louisiana and were milking the Minnesota system. You add to that the recent news media report of a couple living in Florida on a yacht that was collecting welfare benefits from several states, one of them being Minnesota. And I'm beginning to think these examples are the tip of the iceberg, and that this money could be used to help those who really need help rather than being wasted in the system. So my point of sharing this is that I guess I'd like to see us address ways to remedy some of these situations on a bipartisan basis. We have a lot of wisdom and experience sitting at this table, more than I have in some of these areas. But I think when we see this amount of money being wasted in the system when we have unlimited needs at time, is a travesty for our taxpayers and those who really need help. So, Mr. Chair, I just submit that testimony, and hopefully we can, with Mr. Kerber's help, hopefully, and other individuals, come up with some solutions to tighten up the waste, fraud, and abuse in the system. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, and we had the testimony of the department last week, and I'm sure that we will be looking at that with the department bills, as well as bills aimed at waste, fraud, and abuse within that, and I'm sure we will be having the department back to talk more about that in the weeks and months ahead. So I appreciate that, Representative Grunhagen. With that, I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. We now do have a quorum, and we have some minutes to approve. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from January 15th, 2015? I do. Representative McDonald moves approval of the minutes of January 15th, 2015. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Nay. The minutes are approved. Members, we have today the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We're going to be talking about the Minnesota Security Hospital's conditional license. We've got the testifiers at the stand ready to go. And I don't know what the batting order is, but perhaps just as a introduction, particularly to new members, of which we have two currently. I think what would be good is to just go over a little bit about the security hospital and the different uses of the facility and how those two are differentiated. And I know there's a lot of confusion among lots of members about the specific use. So maybe just begin with a very or integrate that into your testimony. Just a little bit of a brief explanation of the facility itself and how that division works and how that is operational. I think that would be helpful. So if you just want to introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I think it does make the most sense to just start with very basic information about who we serve on the St. Peter campus, how the two populations we serve there are different, and then we can move into very specifically talking about the security hospital. So I'd like to proceed that way. All right. Okay, so the first page that I'm going to ask you to look at is, it starts with Forensic Services, the Minnesota Security Hospital. It's a one-page document. It says Forensic Services and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program at St. Peter. It should be in your packet. We put this together because on the St. Peter campus, there are two populations that are served there. They share a campus. Last year, the department was provided bonding money so that we could separate the campuses, an upper campus and a lower campus. Today, they are They share the lower campus, and then the security hospital is up also on the upper campus. Two very different populations served at these two facilities, and you can see the very first thing is the civil commitment type. At the forensic services part of St. Peter, we serve people who are primarily mentally ill and dangerous. They've been committed to us, civilly committed to us by the courts. The other part of the program on campus, the sex offender treatment program, though the courts have committed people to us as either sexually dangerous persons or sexual psychopathic personalities. So very different populations in the two parts of campus. Again, today we're just talking about the column that isn't shaded, the forensic services programs. Both are licensed the same by the health department as supervised living facilities. We also hold DHS licenses for both programs, but they are different licenses. Derek Kerber is here with us today to talk about what it was that we did that created a problem for our Rule 36 facility license. You can see there's accreditation none available on this on the sex offender treatment program side of the campus, but we are accredited by the Joint Commission on Behavioral Health Hospitals. And then again, just some more information for you about the demographics and people who we serve. But we wanted to do this so you could see that there are two very different populations who share a campus. They're committed to us very differently. At some further point, we would be happy to lay out all the different commitments to the commissioner, because people can be committed to the Commissioner of Human Services in many different ways. They can be committed as, in addition to these two commitments, they can be committed as mentally ill, they can be committed as chemically dependent, they can be committed as mentally ill and chemically dependent. There's many, many different ways to be committed to the Commissioner of Human Services, but today we wanted to lay out these two different kinds of commitment because we share a campus, it gets very confusing to everybody. So wanted to just lay out the two differences here.
Thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Berry, I just want to make sure that I understand this. My understanding was, in the past at least, that St. Peter would take people who were considered mentally ill and dangerous but were not involved in the legal system in terms of having committed a crime, but were either voluntarily or civilly committed because of the behavior risk that they presented. And the description here says that they actually have to be involved in the legal system. If they hadn't yet committed a crime, but there's a perceived high risk, would they be then served by another one of your facilities?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, everyone who's at our facility on the St. Peter campus has been civilly committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. The only exception are for the maybe 30 people who are in the competency restoration program, but they still come to us through the courts and through the civil commitment process. The court the court hasn't determined if they're competent to stand trial or not, but they still made their way to us through the court system. Carol Olson is with me. She's the executive director of the program in St. Peter, and I don't know that we have anybody who's come to us who hasn't been committed one of those two ways.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was just that it says due to a crime, and I thought that we had people who had not yet committed a crime but were considered because of acting out, perhaps even on their own property or whatever, that they were posed a danger to themselves and to others and therefore were civilly committed. And if it's not to this place, I just wondered where.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we do have people who come to the commissioner who are civilly committed to the commissioner who haven't been convicted of a crime. They would generally go to either Anoka or one of our community behavioral health hospitals.
Okay.
The bar is very high for the St. Peter campus.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Ms. Berry, please continue with your testimony. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, if one of these individuals commits a felony while in treatment, is he returned back to the prison system if he's convicted?
Ms. Berry.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative, it's taken on a case-by-case basis. We are located in the county. They would make the determination if charges were going to be brought against one of our clients who committed a felony while in our care. So it depends on if the county attorney would bring charges, depending on if there was property damage. Generally, it doesn't happen for property damage, but if somebody was injured by another, one of our staff was injured last January, one of our clients killed another client. He is now currently being served in the criminal justice system. He's no longer in our care.
Representative Gruenhagen.
That's fine.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Ms. Berry. Do you prefer questions intermediate or at the end of your presentation?
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Berry.
I'm finished with this overview piece, and we're getting ready to move into the condition on the license. Both Jerry Kerber and Carol Olson are here to talk about that. So I've finished this basic overview part.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just clarify, because I do have a question and wanted to make sure I had given you the ample time. Regarding the improvements to the facility with the findings of the rear conditional license, just curious as to the cost of the cost and some of the improvements that you made to ensure that you're in compliance with the license, and then some of the security measures were improved.
So,
Ms. Berry, is that something you want to tackle now, or you want to tackle that with the testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I will talk later about the deficiency request, which includes the costs associated with the remodeling. They are also part of our response to the condition on our license and our abatement plan. So it will come up a number of times between now and later in our testimony.
That'll be fine.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Please continue your testimony in any order you'd like to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next up will be Jerry Kerber, who will talk about our Inspector General. He will talk about the actions taken against the security hospital. There have been a number of those actions taken to condition the license. And then Carol Olson is the Executive Director of the program. She will talk specifically about what we have done to respond to those conditions placed on our license.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Mr. Kerber, please state your name for the tape and go ahead with the testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Inspector General for the Department of Human Services. And I think I'll just start by explaining our office a little bit. The Inspector General's office was created just a few years ago in fall of 2011. And it's made up of three divisions. One is the Background City Division, where we do over 300,000 background cities a year, and people provide health care and human services. The other is the Licensing Division, which is what brings me here today. And the third one is the Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigation Division, which, following up on Representative Gruenhagen, will be happy to talk with you about some of those issues that you brought up earlier. And so in our role as the Licensing Division, we license over 20,000 programs in the state of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Security Hospital is one of those 20,000. It's a little unique because, as you have recognized, the commissioner wears multiple hats in the state, and so she is both the provider of services and the regulator of those services. But I report up to her through a different path than Ms. Berry. So my deputy commissioner is Chuck Johnson, and so we work pretty hard to keep our keep the proper walls between us. Although there's not one here today, but we certainly our relationship is that of regulator and provider in 99% of the dealings we have. And so, and I think that's important because our role is really to look at providers of services very objectively throughout the state and not hold them to different standards than we do anybody else. That said, the security hospital is certainly a unique arrangement in that the licensing standards that apply to the security hospital are what we refer to as Rule 36. And Rule 36 is a licensing standard that went into effect in 1983 or 1984, and it was really developed to regulate adult residential mental health programs, usually around 16 beds, that were located in the community. And so a typical one of these facilities would have been a very large house in a neighborhood that had multiple beds, and we licensed it as an adult mental health program. That same licensing standard then applied to the state-operated services, to the regional treatment centers, Anoka and Wilmer and Moose Lake, all had one in the security hospital. They didn't really; those regulations didn't really fit at that time, and they don't fit any better today. Most of those other programs have migrated over to what we call the ERTS arrangement, which is intensive residential treatment services, and that was that migration of those programs over to those standards, also with a specific downsizing to 16 beds, allowed them to collect MA for those services. So there was a really, it was a good arrangement. So the security hospital remains, however, under this set of regulations that was designed really to address community-based programs. So that said, you know, we've been monitoring them, and we have a provision in our licensing act that also, in addition to our regulating the services according to the licensing rule, we also regulate them by holding them accountable for following their own policies and procedures. And so the security hospital obviously has had to develop a number of policies and procedures over time that are unique to that service, and very different from what you'd find in a community residential program. And so that becomes really some of the substance of what our monitoring visits are about. When we monitor programs, we not only visit them every 2 years or so, but we also follow up on complaints. And so we categorize complaints a couple different ways. One is that we look at, is it a possible licensing violation that was represented? Did somebody say staff don't have qualifications, or there weren't enough staff, or my rights were violated and that my mail is open before I get to see it, things like that. On the other hand, we also spend some time investigating what incidents that are reported to us as possible abuse or neglect of a vulnerable adult. Categorically, everybody who's receiving services at the Minnesota Security Hospital is a vulnerable adult under our Minnesota statute. So if we get a report that comes into our office by the mandated reporters who work at the facility, then we investigate every one of those reports. So that's what led to the conditional license that we first issued in December of 2011, is that we were spending some time investigating multiple incidents of seclusion and restraint of these vulnerable adults, and not only looking at it, whether or not, in that case, whether they were, these uses of seclusion and restraint were consistent with the facility policies and consistent with the individual treatment plans, but also was the deviation from those enough to say that it might have been maltreatment under the vulnerable adult statute. So was the facility failing to provide services which were reasonable and necessary for that vulnerable adult, was sort of the standard. And so we were investigating a number of those, and we found in a couple cases that there was use of seclusion and restraint that we found to be maltreatment. And that's really what led to the first conditional license in December of 2011. A couple of the cases that really prompted that related to secluding a man for some period of time without any clothing or any kind of mattress in the room before they could get him a gown. There was another one where an individual was secluded for 25 days without a mattress at all, just on a, if you've ever seen the rooms, there's just a cement slab for a bed. For 25 days that way. Another one where a person was restrained in a prone position, which was very dangerous in his case. And so a lot of what the focus was on our part was that these uses were also not supported by the documentation. So the documentation in the facility records didn't support that excessive use of exclusion and restraint was appropriate or certainly necessary.
Mr. Kerber?
Yes.
Excuse me, just if you wouldn't mind, if it would be okay if we interrupt you with questions as we're going. That's generally the way members like to do it. Could you just talk a little bit about how these or other complaints come to you? And are there, what is this, is the flow of information that would precipitate a complaint? And could you talk a little bit about the different channels that might come through, either through a client, through a family member, through staff, and how those are evaluated and how those come to you?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The reports come to us through all those that you mentioned, all those sources. We get them from family members, certainly we get them from clients themselves and all the programs we license. We get them from staff. We get them from staff who have left a situation and now got a new job, and they're reporting about something that happened where they used to work. We get reports from the community. We kind of get them from neighbors and virtually anybody who sees something going on that they think doesn't seem to be right. We get them from county case managers, from county social workers. We get them from physicians who might be seeing somebody for a medical visit in the community, or staff who work in that physician's office. We get them from virtually anybody. And most of those people are mandated reporters because of the nature of their occupation, but certainly not everybody is. So family members obviously aren't and neighbors aren't mandated reporters. Sometimes a visitor to a facility will see something that they don't think is it seems to sit unwell with them, and they make that report to us. The reporting actually occurs through the county. What we have in Minnesota is what we call the common entry point, and this has been in place since 1995. And so every county is responsible for identifying a phone number that can be called 24 hours a day. And sometimes that changes, and sometimes it rolls over, and they use their 911 operators in Greater Minnesota. But at any rate, there's always has to be somebody to answer the phone in 87 counties and at those common entry points. The system is beginning much more efficient over the last few years and with a lot more technology involved. And the counties now record those reports in our social services information system, or SSIS. It's maintained by the department. And then those reports are, once they come to the county determines what's the right agency to investigate them. And so really there are three categories of lead investigative agency under the Vulnerable Adult Statute. And one is the county adult protection. So every county also has adult protection, or counties that have combined to form a single adult protection function among them. But then the other two are DHS, our office, licensing division. We have a maltreatment investigation unit that does this kind of work, and they also investigate maltreatment of minors when that occurs in a licensed program. But then the third one is the Department of Health, the Office of Health Facility Complaints. And so when a report comes in, a lot of times, you know, the person making the report doesn't really know who's regulating that service. If it's a nursing home, you know, they don't necessarily understand that it's a health department that regulates that and not human services, or it's a home care service. They don't know if it's a PCA or licensed home health agency, or if it's one of our licensed waiver programs from DHS. And so the county's job then is to sort that out and determine, you know, who is the right agency, and then it gets sent to us electronically. And then when it comes to our office, we do a very quick assessment and determine what we're going to do with that report. Once it's assessed as to whether or not it's possibly a licensing issue, or maybe it came to us by mistake and we need to re-refer it, but or whether we're going to investigate that as maltreatment. And in every one of those reports, we send a letter to that original reporter within 5 days telling them what we're doing with that report, and here's a phone number to call if you want to talk to somebody about it. And so then we have investigators who set out to then investigate. If it might be a licensing issue, we have licensing staff who are in the business of being experts in the licensing standards that apply. But then we also have these other people I mentioned, our maltreatment investigation folks who are very well trained in how to investigate maltreatment.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber.
So back in December of 2011, we had a finding of substantiated maltreatment, substantiated neglect by the facility. And one thing we also do when we do these investigations, if we substantiate that there's maltreatment, the next step under the law is that we have to make a determination about who is responsible for that. Was it an individual, or was it the facility? And there are criteria in the law that are well-defined that walk us down that path. Did the facility have adequate policies and procedures in place? Did they train staff on those? Did they adequately supervise people or not? And so if a facility has done really what they could reasonably be expected to do, and there's an errant employee who goes off and does something that they ought not to have done, and they've been trained on what they should have done instead, then we're more likely to blame that individual, or we're going to identify that individual was responsible for maltreatment. However, if the facility's policies are unclear, or they're not compliant with the regulations, or the training was non-existent, or the oversight doesn't seem to be there, then we're more likely to go back to the facility and say, you know, you are the ones really that played a role in this. And that gets significant because of the next consequence. We can disqualify individuals under our background study law, and that's done by our background study division, or we can issue a licensing sanction if we find the facility responsible. And so in this case, we determined that a facility sanction was appropriate, and we issued a two-year conditional license against the Minnesota Security Hospital. And then we were going along, and the terms of that, you know, there are always terms identified in the conditional license, and we'll be hearing more about the specific terms that are in place now. But basically, you know, we require some training, we require better oversight, clarification of policies and procedures. And I'll just say that at that time, in 2011, in December, it was a very different arrangement than what we have today. There was very different leadership at the facility. And the policies and procedures that were in effect were multiple. They were inconsistent. Staff were not familiar with them, and there were a lot of people who kind of implemented intervention procedures in the way that they found to be the most rewarding for them, one way or another. And so there was a lot of inconsistency. And so the facility really took that first order very seriously and began working very, very aggressively on policies and procedures and getting them straightened out across the facility and then training staff on them. What then happened is that while there was really kind of a culture shift that was occurring, because the facility was very interested in moving away from sort of the fast, frequent, and for long periods of time use of seclusion and restraint into a lot more person-centered approach. And staff actually developing more relationships with the clients, there was some misunderstanding of the direction that the facility wanted to go. And maybe in there some resistance by staff. And so, unfortunately, some of that was interpreted to mean that with the new procedures that are required of us, we can no longer intervene when patients are violent. And under the person-centered approach, we need to let people do whatever they want, and that's the new expectation. If I intervene in this situation, I'm going to probably lose my job. I mean, we heard all of those kinds of reactions, and unfortunately, we saw that come to play a bit later when there was a case where an individual was actually engaged in some pretty serious self-injurious behavior where he was banging his head against the wall repeatedly for a long period of time, and staff, some of the staff said that it was their understanding that they were not to intervene unless he started to hurt somebody else. And so ultimately this person ended up going to the emergency room with some pretty severe injuries that he had caused to himself. And so it was at that point that we extended that was the first extension on the conditional license. And we required them to do more training and to provide better supervision again of staff. And things were progressing until about a year ago. I just was informed it was a year ago last week, or next week, when there was the case where one patient at the facility killed another patient. And again, what we found in that case is that we were disappointed to see that when we interviewed the patients that were living on the unit, they were aware that there was some real tension brewing over several hours in the evening between patients. The staff were in the office away from the patients, and staff didn't realize what was all going on, and somebody had been assaulted very seriously and was laying on the floor dying for an hour and a half before staff came upon the person. And this is a relatively contained unit, seven staff, 14 patients. And so, you know, it was really a tragedy. I think everybody agrees. And so at that point, we really looked more deeply at what did we think as the regulators needed to be done to really get the new message out there to staff. And so, you know, in the course of that investigation, again, we had heard things from employees like they were unempowered, their tools had been removed, they didn't think that they could intervene anyway. There were a lot of perceptions that staff had that supported their not being involved at all in the patient care and not intervening in a situation that was developing over the course of that evening. And so what we ordered the facility to do in the extended conditional license was really to do a lot more related to that direct oversight of these employees. Basically, we wanted there to be a very severe commitment to the training of all employees and a check-in with all employees about whether they're on board or not with the new approaches that are going to be used. We recognize that not everybody was capable of translating classroom training into that very tense and emotional situation that occurs on some of the units at the security hospital. I mean, they're very dangerous events that are occurring. And the expectation is that somebody's going to be able to translate then something they heard in a classroom to that situation. And so really what we talked about and what we ended up ordering is that there would be somebody on the units on those shifts that was steeped in the understanding of the new approaches that the facility was interested in using, so that they could be modeling that behavior and teaching staff along the way. And so I think some of the results have been very, very impressive, and I think you're going to hear about some of those now, that the use of seclusion restraint has gone down. I think staff injuries have gone down. But that's kind of the, in a nutshell, our conditional license. So at first there was there was an excessive use of seclusion and restraint that then the pendulum swung way to the other side where there were staff not intervening and not involved with patients, and incidents were occurring. So now it's swinging back, and I'm happy to say that the facility is making a lot of progress.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Ms. Olson, you would like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chair and representatives. My name is Carol Olson. I'm the executive director of the Forensic Services in St. Peter, which includes Minnesota Security Hospital. There are two documents that talk about the terms of the conditional license. One is a pretty extensive document. I will reference, though, the one-page handout that has on the top of it Minnesota Security Hospital conditional license May 20th, 2014 extension update. So I'll reference this one because it's a little bit more concise. So what is on this is each of the terms of the conditional license that was given to us with the extension in May of 2014, so this last May. I'm going to go through each of the terms and what we've done to date, but feel free to interrupt and ask questions if you want. So the first term that was applied to us was that we needed to strengthen the executive leadership on the campus and to develop and implement a cohesive strategic leadership plan that provided guidance and transparency as such to all the staff on the unit. We put together what we felt was going to strengthen that executive leadership, which probably the key positions were a full-time medical director, which we have successfully been able to fill, and Dr. Kylie Stevens joined our team on 11-10-14. Up until this period of time, Dr. Pratt had been providing the medical director services to our program, but he was also wearing two hats. One was the medical director for DHS, and so having a full-time medical director has certainly strengthened our team. We also have a full-time medical services administrator who oversees all the medical services on the campus, and then are currently filling a quality manager lead position, and so that's another key executive leadership team member that we are adding to our team. But part of term one was that to really enhance the person-centered training that was occurring with our staff. We were on the road of providing this person-centered training, but it was not at a pace that we really needed to move forward with. And the terms of the conditional license laid out an expectation that we were to get all of our staff through this training in a short order. And so that began in July, or excuse me, in May, and continued until and through October, where we really got close to 100% of our staff through training. We have ongoing staff that we continue to put through training, and those are our new employees as they come on board. So we completed that. The second part of term one was to hire the full-time medical director, and as I stated before, we have brought on Dr. Kylie Stevens, who started with us in November. Part of that term was also to develop a code of conduct. In other words, a document that lays out the expectations of how we engage with each other on that campus, all staff with each other, how leaders and supervisors need to engage with employees, and how we as executive team members need to engage with employees. That document was signed by all staff members on the campus. It was reviewed, and 100% of the staff have now signed that document. Term two of the conditional license required us to provide clinical supervision minimally weekly on each of our treatment environments. The essence of this is really helping those direct care staff that are there 24/7, the nursing staff, the security counselors, recreation staff, others, really understand the clinical direction for each of the individuals that they're serving, what are those individuals' vulnerabilities, and to review that and continue to change that each week as the clinical picture of patients change. So that was initiated initially on Unit 800, which is where the death of the patient occurred, but has rolled out to each of the treatment environments. Those clinical supervision meetings are done by a mental health professional, which is a statute language that dictates who can fill that requirement. And so those were initiated, as I said, and are since September of 2014 have been implemented all of our treatment environments. The term three of the conditional license, which is actually also was tied to term seven, was beyond just putting staff through the person-centered thinking classes. Which is a two-day or 12-hour class. We also provided enhanced training to staff in each of the treatment environments such that we would have what we call our person-centered coaches on each of the treatment units. And those coaches, we have a coach that's assigned to each of the treatment environments from 6 in the morning until 10 at night on all of our treatment environments. And on four of our highest acute units, we have a person-centered coach that's there during the night shift also. So we initiated that also on Unit 800 again, which is where the death of the patient occurred, and then rolled out having coaches on each of the treatment environments starting on October 31st. Both the two-day person-centered training as well as the enhanced training for the coaches required a lot of staff training, and so that's why we slowly rolled it out and eventually were able to put coaches on each of our units starting in October. Along with that, we have continued to do what we call coaching circles. So we continue to bring those coaches together minimally one time a month so that they can keep talking about lessons learned, what's working, what's not working. Each of our treatment environments are a bit unique and each provide different kinds of challenges, so it's helpful to coaches to get together and sort of talk about that. And they meet with two staff who are coaching leaders on our campus.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Loeffler.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Olson, I just want to understand if the coaches are people who've come from outside, who've worked in environments that, you know, person-centered thinking and approaches are just sort of embedded, or was this just some more intensive training for people who were working at the facility before? And if so, what was the intensity of the training that was provided to them so that it was, you know, more than just an overview and a special responsibility?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the staff that were trained to be coaches are staff that are hired on my campus. So all of the staff went through a two-day person-centered coaches training that was provided by an instructor who came from outside our system and provided that. And then that same individual that came from outside the forensic system trained our coaches. It was three consecutive Wednesdays with homework assignments and having to be responsible to come back reporting what they'd learned. And then the coaching circles are also being facilitated by leaders on our campus who have gone through additional training. So it's continuing to enhance staff that step to the forefront to be coaches and want to lead us in this direction.
Thank you, Ms. Olson.
You're welcome. So term four, the conditional license was to be more aggressive in completing our individual treatment plans and individual abuse prevention plans when we have individuals who are admitted into our facility and also individuals who transfer from one unit to another. So the time frame was moved up for those documents to be completed with 8 hours, and with that, staff trained on those documents within 2 hours of them initiating a shift working with those individuals. And again, that was just to really enhance our staff's understanding of the direction clinically for each individual patient and what are their vulnerabilities, and to pay attention to those and to keep people safe. Term five of the conditional license was to align organizational structure in each of the units. What licensing correctly identified is that our treatment environments really had three chains of command. We had the chain of command of our professional staff, which would include our social workers, our psychologists, our behavior analysts, recreational therapists, who reported up a clinical chain of command. We had our security counselors who were reporting up the unit director chain of command, and then we had our nursing staff who supported units who were reporting up a nursing chain of command. And when you have those three chains of command, you get different direction going to staff, and it doesn't unite a unit the way you need to in order to make sure everybody's on the same page and working in the same direction with patients. So term five of the conditional license asked us to collapse that, to have that one chain of command that directs the day-to-day functions of the unit and holds people accountable to doing those day-to-day operations on that treatment environment. And so that has been aligned that way. We still have clinical staff who are monitoring clinical expertise of staff, you know, so social workers looking over to make sure social workers are meeting the license expectations, but that day-to-day operations and direction given comes from the unit director on the unit. Term six of the conditional license was to update the program abuse prevention plan for unit 800. Each of our units has their own abuse prevention plan, and then we create individual abuse prevention plans, and so we needed to update the program abuse prevention plan in Unit 800, and that was done. Term 8, which sort of wraps them together, a lot of the things that we've been trying to do, was to conduct unscheduled observations. So in terms of putting that unit structure underneath a unit director, bringing staff, educating staff and helping them understand person-centered concepts and how to engage patients in person-centered ways, and were the clinical supervision meetings and helping staff understand the clinical direction of the patients, was that all coming together, and how were we monitoring that? And so term 8 of the conditional license asked us to put together what is referred to as our unscheduled observations. Those are being done in multiple levels. We have unscheduled observations happening from our security counselor leads going from one unit to another, so off their own unit to go to another unit to do an unscheduled observation. We have our unit directors providing unscheduled observations at a supervisory level. We have our executive members doing some unscheduled observations. We have members of our quality management team coming into our units and doing some unscheduled observations. Our last layer that we're going to be adding to this that we haven't yet, but we'll be doing so this spring, is bringing in outside advocacy groups to come in and do some unscheduled observations. So what we hope to see is, we are hoping to see, and we are, staff engaged with patients, staff understanding the clinical direction of patients, staff engaging in person-centered ways. And so all those things are being captured with our unscheduled observations.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Are those, when you did those unscheduled observations, did you come away with any negative reports? And then are those reports available to members of the committee?
Yep. So we were required to submit reports of the unscheduled observations to licensing quarterly. The first report that was due in August, and that was in specifically for Unit 800. And then we roll those out to all of the rest of the treatment environments. The first report we submitted to licensing was in November, and we have another one due, I believe, at the end of this month that we'll be reporting to licensing, and yes, those are available. What we walked away from is, a need to continue to train our staff to be engaged with our patients. I think that we've seen some movement in that regard. We've adjusted the expectation around presence on the unit. That's one of our new policies. It used to be called rounds, and staff had to make rounds, and then we changed it to being present. You need to be present on the unit. Unless there's a reason to be in the office, you should be present on the unit and engaged with patients. And so we're seeing some shifting.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the testimony. I was just looking at this this handout here, Forensic Services, Minnesota Sex Offender Program, and on there it shows the number of clients in the system, and it has two columns there, and one shows the number of staff at 845, or about 2 to 2.5 staff for every client. The other column shows 252 clients and 306 staff, which is about a little over 1.5, probably 1.2. I was just corrected. per client, and I'm just wondering, there's got to be a reason for that. So just why would the staffing ratios be so much different in these two programs?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair, the underneath the forensic services, that 845 represents also all the support staff that support the whole for St. Peter campus. So dietary, for example, provides meals for both the Minnesota Sex Offender Program as well as all the Forensic Services Program. Our grounds, our maintenance, our electricians, our plumbers, all of those, everything that supports the whole campus is located, those FTEs are located under Forensic Services on the St. Peter campus. That would
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, thanks. I knew there was a relatively rational explanation for that. I just couldn't see it when I first looked at it. The other question I just have in follow-up is, several years ago I saw a news report that on these programs that our cost per inmate here in the state of Minnesota is quite a bit higher than other states with similar programs on how they address these clients. Do you know how our program rates in terms of comparative with other states that have similar programs in terms of cost and effectiveness? Is there any type of document we can reference to look at that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know that we have a cost comparison. I know that we have visited two facilities in particular that serve a very similar population to what we serve in our forensic program in St. Peter, and their staffing ratios are much higher than ours. As an example, we currently have our psychiatric coverage at, I think our FTEs are close to 10 FTEs, in a facility in Oregon had over 30 FTEs, a psychiatrist, for a very similar population. But I don't think that we've ever done a comparison of per diem.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Olson, I think this would be directed at yourself as well. And you talked about not simply making the rounds, but being present, being with the patient. Are there certain requirements or duties or mandates that makes makes it more difficult to spend with the patient and forces the individuals into the office. And the reason I bring that up is because one of my mistakes as a freshman, folks back home were saying, eliminate mandates, and makes it so prohibitive for us to do that. And so I charged up here as a freshman and said, eliminate mandates. And people said, all right, which mandates do you want to eliminate? And I said, oh, I'll be right back, you know, because I didn't know. So are there specific, like I said, duties, requirements, or mandates in place that makes it more difficult for the people to actually work with the patient?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there we have requirements for staff to do progress noting and do all kinds of environmental rounds and checks to make sure that the environment is safe. Those are probably two of the things that staff will speak the most about is documentation requirements that draw them into a nursing office in order to do that documentation.
Representative Chairman. Hamilton.
So, Ms. Olson, is all that, does that make better care for the patient? Is any of those requirements, can those, somehow could that be streamlined or anything? I guess that's the point I'm trying to make.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we're always looking at ways of trying to streamline that, yet at the same time with our, you know, regulating bodies that oversee us, things that are not documented are not done in their eyes. And so, you know, as we provide care and treatment and services and we're implementing a treatment plan, we need to document patients' progress in those goals and objectives and what's occurring with them day to day in order to show progress and to show that staff are doing what they're supposed to be doing too. So there's a balance there, and we try to look for efficiencies.
Yeah. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is where, you know, I've said it appears to me that the tail wags the dog. You are the professionals, right? The individuals providing the care are the professionals, and we should treat them as such. And if there's just feel-good things taking place to appease people that are not directly working with the patient, then we should be addressing that. And again, that's where I think a lot of this comes in. It's to make somebody else feel good, but are we actually getting the desired results because of it, or are we making it more difficult for the people that are actually providing the care? So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was going to just follow up on Representative Grunhagen's question that I thought was a good one about why the number of staff are so different in the two facilities, and I just wanted to ask a follow-up to that, and then I have something also a comment on Representative Hamilton's comment, but I wanted to see, you mentioned, Ms. Olson, that there are some services that are provided for both campuses, and that accounts for some of the difference. I wanted to ask you whether that those services, the cost of those services are baked into the different per diems, because the per diems are very different according to this document that you've given us. And I don't exactly understand either why there's a range given for the forensic services. You must be referring to different parts of the hospital there, but could you just give us a little bit more information on that?
Ms. Olson or Ms. Berry?
So I'll start and you can... So the range and the per diems, we have four different programs that fall within the forensic programs. We have our forensic nursing home. That is the highest per diem, the 618. That is staffed primarily with RNs, LPNs. We do not use security counselors in that program. Occupational therapists, physical therapists, social workers. The lowest per diem is our forensic transition services program, I believe, and then we have a competency restoration program, and then Minnesota Security Hospital. Those are the four programs. Our staffing ratio is higher than Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The individuals that we serve come to us with very acute mental health conditions that we're treating. And so we use a whole range of professional staff, psychiatry, medical staff who provide medical care for our patients. We have a dentist within our services, psychologists, social workers, recreational therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, special teachers, a whole vocational program. Our average length of stay with the Minnesota Security Hospital is close to 7 years. And so we provide that full array of services in order to help our individuals get ready to move back into society and be productive members.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to follow up on Representative Hamilton's comment and just to say that I think that's very commendable, and I think we all share that goal of reducing unnecessary regulation, and we definitely want people to do the jobs that they are trained to do to the best of their ability. But I think that what we see in this particular situation is that it's a lot more complicated than that, because the whole scenario that's being described here is one where the people who were doing the care were, in fact, kind of off on the wrong foot, and that some pretty nasty things were happening in the not-so-distant past. And then you have the regulating body that comes in and puts some regulations or says, you're not meeting the regulations, we've got to enforce our regulations, and I think we've seen some distinct improvement because of that regulation. So I think while we'd all like to remove unnecessary regulations, of course the rub is what's really unnecessary. And I just wanted to put that out there, because it's, even though every individual thinks, we as individuals always think that we're doing the very best we can and we want other people to leave us alone so that we can do it, of course we're not always objective, and you know, we do need that regulatory piece to make sure the outcomes are what we expect. And of course, if people weren't required to document things, we wouldn't know what's going on there either. So there is a balance to be struck. Maybe automation can help make that documentation easier. I don't know. And certainly I think we'd all be looking for Ms. Olson and Commissioner Berry to tell us if there are things that they see that we can do to help make this whole process smoother, better for patients, hopefully cheaper for everybody, and so on. And I'm sure they know that if such a thing, if such an animal is out there, we'd all like to know what it is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Olson, I'm just wondering about employee. I imagine that this is just a high-stress job. I can't even fathom. Could you just talk a little bit about your retention rate with your employees?
Ms. Olson.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Representative, we actually, probably the area that we have the highest turnover in is in our psychology pool of staff and in nursing. Psychology, we hire a lot of individuals who have just completed their education and have come to us either through a fellowship program and or come to us right from college. And they will put in, I shouldn't say put in their time, they do a great job for us, but they will complete their licensure requirements, become licensed, and then they can move to other jobs that will pay them a lot more money and help with other things like tuition reimbursement and some things that we're our hands are a bit tied in doing. So we have that's probably one of our pools of people that we see the greatest amount of turnover. LPNs, we have a lot of turnover, but that's because a lot of individuals start as LPNs and then go on to school to become RNs. And so that's a harder position to fill for that reason, and when we fill it, oftentimes they don't stay with us very long as LPNs. And sometimes stay within our program as an RN, which is great. Sometimes they go elsewhere. And then certainly our psychiatric services. When I started in March of 2012, we had only one full-time psychiatrist working in our program. The rest had all left. And we hired our first psychiatrist in September of 2013. It took that long to bring on a psychiatrist. We've been successful, though, in filling some more of our psychiatric positions, which is really helpful. But it's a long, drawn-out process to hire a psychiatrist.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. And I just, this is probably a good time to ask a question that I was would like answered, which is, in dealing with restraints in particular, not just in this program, but in many programs across the state and that the programs we'll see in this committee, we're dealing with court decisions and restraints and people not really knowing how to apply the rules to their job and to this patient. And to having a patient-centered approach is obviously what everyone's supposed to do and what would be best. And what I heard Mr. Kerber say is that we've had an instance of somebody hitting their head against the wall and people working there not knowing whether or not they should intervene. Am I going to lose my job? Is this outside? It seems like it's difficult for people on the ground dealing with vulnerable adults and patients to know what their job is supposed to be. And there's a price to be paid for that in terms of services that are not being provided in some cases, in some cases of things that are being provided that shouldn't be. And then also, I think another price is that perhaps people who work for the state, good, hardworking people with tough jobs, don't want to share that they don't know what to do. One of the things that I think I didn't see in the terms is a survey of the people who work there, and just to say, do you know what you're supposed to be doing, and can you provide feedback on that? Have you done any surveys like that with employees that don't have their names attached to them, and are those being fed back through?
Yeah. So within our forensic program, we've actually completed three consecutive years of surveys, and it's called our staff engagement survey. And then last year there was a survey that was done with all staff across DHS, and it sorted out staff in different program areas, but it also sorted out direct care employees from professional staff, from supervisors and managers, we rated some of the areas we rated the lowest is in communication. So I think that speaks towards your question. I think staff want to do what's right, and they want to understand what they should be doing. And what we have attempted to do because of the results of those surveys is really engage staff in lots of ways to enhance that communication, and in multiple ways. So from verbal to written to classroom settings to getting out there so staff can speak one-to-one with us. And we need to continue to do more and more of that all the time.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. And are those blind surveys? So if I turn in a survey, my name's not on that survey. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Ms. Berry.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could add at least one more thing that, but we've made it very clear to employees that if there's something wrong, we want them to report what has gone wrong. If we know about a problem, we can fix it and we can address it. And at the same time, let people know that we will do everything we can to protect you as an employee of the state. We can't tell licensing what to do when they take their actions, but as an employer of people in the business of direct care and treatment, we've gone, a long way to trying to assure our employees that we will do everything we can to make sure that you're not the one who's blamed for information you didn't have, or if you reported something that you needed to report. Those have been really important things. It certainly gets the attention of licensing and other people looking at us a lot, and the amount of people and oversight that takes place in our programs is pretty remarkable, but we want staff to know that if you see a problem, raise it. We will do everything we can to make sure that not only do we address it, but that you, as the person who has raised the issue, is protected.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Olson, you, I believe, hit it right on the head when you said staff, they want to do the right thing. They want to do what's right. And that's my point in the initial line of questioning. And I understand what Representative Liebling is saying as far as striking a balance. What I think that we have a tendency to do, and I'm talking we, legislators, we have a tendency is if there's a bad actor out there, we end up legislating for because of that bad actor, and then subsequently treating everybody else as if they're a bad actor. And, you know, consequences around that is all of a sudden you're basically treating people or and making them into criminals, if you will, if they don't follow every step along the way. But everything's different. Each person is different. And so I just hope that we're not strapping the hands of the people that are providing the quality of care. That's my biggest concern here. And so it comes back to treating people like professionals that they are. Given people, most people, they do want to do what's right. And so let's not treat them like criminals, if you will. Let's make sure that we're dealing with the bad actors accordingly. Deal with the bad actors accordingly, but don't treat everybody like a bad actor. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hamilton, I just respond to that. There's two things that I think are important to know, and I think, you know, certainly as the regulator, we agree with everything you're saying. When we issue this conditional license, we also certainly communicated that, you know, this is our best effort at what we think ought to be done in order to get the facility back into compliance and performing good services. But that, you know, we don't, as the regulator sitting in St. Paul, don't have all the answers. And so we have invited, you know, feedback about our conditions and offered the flexibility to modify some. And so we have modified some of our conditions. If you were to read our conditional license, you might also find that where we're requiring the facility to develop some kinds of policies and procedures on how they're going to be dealing with these stressful situations, in almost every one of those cases, we required that they also consult with staff, with line staff, on developing those procedures, so that there isn't, so that it kind of builds the notion that we're all in this together. And to the extent that the regulators are too, we kind of accept that role, that, you know, our ultimate goal is compliance by programs, and it isn't certainly that, you know, we gotcha kind of mentality here. Everybody's better off if programs are doing what they ought to be doing. And we have a general authority in the licensing statute that gives us permission to grant variances to programs too. So we have these regulations that exist, but we also can entertain any suggestion that a license holder has about how they would like to do it differently than our regulations dictate. And so if they can come up with an alternative equivalent measure that essentially gets at the same intended outcome, you know, in most cases we're going to approve that because, you know, the regulations, they are somewhat designed to, you know, kind of a broad brush application, one size fits all. And so if it doesn't fit, we want to individually enforce those regulations as it makes the most sense. So,
and to that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. To that point, do the regulators then, do they go out and actually work side by side to see if those regulation requirements actually work? Case in point, we can make some changes in the business that I'm affiliated with, and then staff will say, look, we can do that, but we're going to be here till 9 o'clock at night. You know, is that really what you want? Is it counterproductive? And so are we sure that the suggestions that we're making back to the facilities actually are viable? Are they viable?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, I think, you know, with, as I mentioned, there's 20,000 license holders out there, and certainly we're more engaged with some of them than others. And certainly with the Minnesota Security Hospital, there's continuous dialogue going on about what the regulations, whether it fits or not, and whether there should be adjustments made. And, you know, this Minnesota Sex Offender Program is operating almost entirely under a variance because the Rule 26 standards that are listed on here, you know, they don't fit anymore as they did in 1995 if they did then. And so we want to believe they are, but it's an ongoing dialogue that we have with license holders providing those services to get there.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a question for Ms. Olson, and I'm just following up really on the chair's question about the staff, the direct care staff, not necessarily always knowing what to do. And I'm wondering if there are, if it's possible to also imagine, or if there are examples of times when staff haven't done what was expected because they're concerned about their own personal safety. And if you could share any information with us about that.
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the best way to answer that is that, you know, what we have tried to do is help our unit directors be out there and available for staff and to engage staff. And when there's difficult situations with patients that are occurring that they don't feel like they know necessarily how to engage with that patient or help de-escalate that patient or keep everybody safe, that they've got resources that they can bring to the table. You know, I'll give you an example of a particular patient that we have right now who is challenging all of us. And she has a pretty complicated diagnosis and, you know, challenges of her own that she's dealing with. And last week there was multiple conversations with staff on the unit and the professional staff and multiple team meetings to talk about best approaches and bringing resources, pharmacological to behavioral support kinds of resources, and even some suggestion that we should reach outside our agency to look towards some expertise, and I fully supported that. So I don't know if that answers your question. But there are certainly very complicated cases that we deal with, and there's no easy answer with every single one provides a challenge.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Ms. Olson. I have some history working with nurses in the state, and of course have heard there have always been examples, I think, of direct care workers in facilities being injured or harmed in the discharge of their responsibilities. And I'm just curious to know if in the conversations that are occurring, if there are things that are being suggested that aren't we're not able to manage because of budgetary constraints. Are there ever concerns about inadequate numbers of staff people or ideas that the direct care staff are suggesting that we can't accomplish because we don't have the funds available to do that?
Ms. Olson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, this might be a nice tie-in to one of the issues that are raised with us is our staff took a concern to OSHA about unsafe work conditions, and we were cited because of unsafe work conditions for the staff. We asked to engage with a mediator and brought to the table our AFSCME partners and our M&A partners, as well as Ann Berry and myself, and then worked with the mediator. And that process and how we engaged the staff that were sitting at the table was to ask them, what would you like to see us do to make it safer? And through that process, we came up with what is our OSHA abatement plan, which is one of the documents that I think Ann's going to be going over it. But that was driven directly from the staff, the direct care staff, the staff that are there 24/7, the nursing staff, the security counselors, the human service specialists, those staff. Brought to the table what they thought we should be doing in order to make it safer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, if I could add, address the budget side of that question. I think it's pretty well known. We have a deficiency request. We are also trying to manage other cost overruns in the programs, many which came as a result of adding staff to our program so we could create a safer environment. Unit staff, particularly, and because we are very closely scrutinizing every position, there are concerns from staff, but the positions that move right through the system are those nursing staff directly on the unit, psychiatrists, LPNs, the medical care staff, and again, the staff that are directly working on our units. We've tried not to slow any of those positions because we know proper staffing is one of the best ways that we can keep people safe.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to follow up on the safety issue. And I had noticed that in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's recommendations, I mean, back in 2011, they had noted that our injury rate for our employees was twice the national average for psychiatric and forensic type hospitals. And, you know, that's a pretty scary thing to go to work and worry about your own safety and whether you'll come home with, you know, injuries or that sort of thing. It's also very scary for the people who are being served there, because I'm sure the injuries happen to them as well as to the staff when someone loses control and just strikes out whatever person's near them, whether they have a name tag on or not. And I'm wondering if you could get us some updated data on whether or not all these changes have really made a difference in terms of what we're seeing on the injury rates, both at, this only gives for the staff, but I'd also like to see for the residents and the patients, because I can't imagine, you know, how distressing it was to go through the loss of a patient at the hands of another. And I think of those people who are committed. They have no idea when they're going to get out. If the average stay is 7 years, I assume you build a relationship with whoever's your assigned roommates or pod mates or whatever, you know, unit you're in. And, you know, I didn't see in all the process recommendations that came out of these conditional licenses anything that was related to incident response. And our first responders have very detailed protocols that they follow whenever they're involved in a crisis situation that goes awry. And we've learned from our first responders, whether they're police or fire or ambulance, that their recovery is often very much supported by that response along with everyone else. And I just didn't see any of that in the, it was very process oriented. If you could just follow up or let us know if we've evolved on that as well.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler and Ms. Olson. And I think you've got about three or four other conditions. We probably want to wrap those up relatively quickly so we can get the deficiency request and have any time for questions by the end of the term here. So,
okay, so Mr.
if you'd
Chair,
like to conclude with that, that would be awesome. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think I will finish with the conditional license terms and then ask. We have our abatement plan that we can go over that speaks more directly to the representative's questions about actions that we're taking to make our environment safer. So the, really, there's only one last term that I will highlight, and that has to do with Term 9, which was to conduct an analysis of the most appropriate placement for admissions and crisis patients and appropriate licensing standards. So we have worked with multiple partners, a lot of our advocacy groups, Minnesota Department of Health, licensing, and others at the table to take a look at how best should Minnesota Security Hospital be licensed. As Jerry spoke of, Rule 36 is an older license, and it doesn't necessarily apply very nicely to Minnesota Security Hospital. We are very close to completing that report. It was initially requested that we have it done by January 15th. We asked for a little bit of an extension from licensing to January 30th. We will have that report ready and sent to licensing by then. But we'll primarily be looking at a continuum of care levels within Minnesota Security Hospital, where our individuals get admitted, which is in the most acute phase of their mental health, and as they move to treatment-focused environments where they're working at reintegration into the community. So a continuum of that care level is what that report will reflect. Did you want to cover the abatement? So that
thank you, Ms. Hull.
Is really what I was going to cover with the terms of the conditional license, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just one other question that I would have is just on the facility itself. I know before I took my first tour of the facility, I heard reports about how the sight lines were so poor, the stairs were blind, it was a difficult place to work. And in my head, I pictured a building like from the 1890s or something with towers and staircases and things. And then you get there and you realize that it's kind of a goofy 1970s building, but it's also one that's hard to work in. Have there been specific facility upgrades proposed within your capital requests that make it an easier and safer place to work? And I know that we had toured it, and I'm just not really remembering exactly how that integrates with the safety aspects. And maybe for those of the folks on the committee who are or have been on the Capital Investment Committee could just get a quick update on that.
Yeah, certainly. So last year, the first phase of the bonding was approved, and construction is underway. At the completion of this first phase of bonding, we will have two admission units, each two-bed admission units. We will have two crisis units that are each two six-bed crisis units, and then acute housing units. How that is different from how we currently operate is in Minnesota Security Hospital, our unit 800 and 900, 800 is where the death occurred of the one individual, and 900 is our only women's unit within Minnesota Security Hospital. Those two units serve admissions and crisis and individuals who are moving ahead in their treatment progression, all in that one treatment environment. So with when we are finished with the first phase of bonding, we'll be able to successfully have individuals served in the right kind of setting, smaller settings, depending on clinically where they're at. Part of the results of the death of the patient, as well as staff concerns about safety, we are remodeling an area within Minnesota Security Hospital, and we'll be opening it up in February to house our admissions. It'll be a four-bed admissions unit, so that'll serve in the interim between now and when our new construction is to be completed, which is the fall of 2016. And that will allow us to have admissions in a separate area from crisis, which is will be served on 800 and 900. We've also added a lot of cameras so that those sight lines and those areas where staff are having to go to check on patients can be checked first by cameras, and we can monitor activities by camera, and we can also look back on events that occurred to see lessons learned, and the facility, the installation of the cameras is complete.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. In the tragedy that happened last year, could you talk about the murder that took place? How did the one patient kill another patient? Was there a weapon involved? And then also, where did this happen in the facility? Was this in a blind spot of the building? And just wondering how somebody, you know, could lay there like that for that long without getting spotted.
Sir, Mr. Chair. So the individual who assaulted the person and in the end he died was from our competency restoration program, and he had been showing some pretty assaultive sorts of behaviors on the competency restoration unit, which is less equipped to deal with people who are in crisis. And so he was moved to our 800 unit, which is again where admissions and crisis go together. The individual that was assaulted was a newer admission. He was demonstrating his mental health, demonstrated in a way that he was pretty reclusive and not reaching out to staff, spent most of his time in his bedroom. And so the one individual went into his bedroom, which bedrooms aren't visible from the unit station, and assaulted him. He did not use a weapon, just assaulted him with his hands and feet. Our staff, based on licensing investigation and our own investigation, were to have been doing hourly checks. And from the results of the investigation, staff had not completed the hourly checks like they were supposed to. And so the person ended up laying on the floor after having been assaulted for a longer period of time than if those hourly rounds would have been done. When staff did do the rounds, they found him on the floor and at that point attempted resuscitation, but he was not able to be revived.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick comment. The you know, the people who work in this area need to be commended. I did jail ministry for 13 years, and you know, some of the individuals, anyway, you need to be commended for working in that area, especially the staff, which one of them lives in my district, at least one that I've talked to about this. But, you know, the thing I just want to reiterate is comparative data. You know, Representative Loeffler just shared a little comparative data in terms of safety, two and a half times the natural national average. Well, that gives us insight as lay people. You know, I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, whether there's more money or not, whatever, comparative data with, you know, 5-7 different states, and there's got to be some out there in terms of safety, staffing, to the number of clients and efficiencies and results that are out there on a comparative basis. I mean, it, as lay people, otherwise we're just sitting around looking at these numbers and we got nothing to compare them to. But once you compare a national statistic like Representative Loeffler did, it immediately gives insight into where there's problem areas, and then we can take proper steps. So I would, you know, just strongly request that either the staff here with our committee or the testifiers give us some type of comparative data. I got to believe it's out there. So anyway, just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. And Ms. Olson or Ms. Berry, would you like to continue with some of the deficiency requests or proceed however you would like to in the next 10 minutes? If we could wrap up, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, I will do so. I just want to suggest you take a look at the abatement plan. It's quite a long document. It's the document the agreement that came out of a mediation with labor, with licensing, with the court monitor in the Jensen case, and was mediated by Judge Poust in the Office of Administrative Hearings. In the end, the settlement was agreed to by labor, by the department. There's been one objection to it, so we have to wait to see what labor and industry will do with it. But I think the importance of this document is that it gets at a number of the things, Representative Loeffler, that you raised, which are incident command, how do we train people in that first response, how do people gain the kind of confidence they need. If you've never worked on a unit before, it's a very scary environment. If you don't know what you're doing, very uncomfortable. In fact, all three of us have worked on units at some point in our career, and we know that you have to be trained and prepared to be able to do so. You won't create a therapeutic environment without that. So I just, again, wanted you to take a look at all the work that's been done really to address the issue of safety, because it was raised by OSHA as a citation. Let me take the last few minutes then to talk about the deficiency that we are running in Security Hospital, and the governor's recommended deficiency request. You have a one-page document. It starts with overview. I think it was probably the second document in your packet. I'm not going to cover back, front and back side. It could have been titled deficiency, my apologies. But it starts by, in December of 2011, I don't want to repeat everything that's been said here, but remember there were three actions against our license. December 2011, we were overusing restraint and seclusion. August of 2013, we were underusing intervention so somebody didn't hurt themselves. And then in January of 2014, one client kills another client. All these things added up to a place where licensing placed a number of conditions on our license. You've heard about those. But they all meant increases in staff, adding security cameras, remodeling a unit so we can take people in crisis and separate them from other people. All of these things were additional costs that weren't in our budget, which all have led to this deficiency request that is in front of you. We really believe that we could have managed the first deficiency that started in December of 2011. We began to add staff and fully realized all those staff in this biennium. We think we could have managed it, except that a number of other things were happening in our system. If you turn over the page, before I step back into even more detail about what happened at Security Hospital, you'll see on the second side, during the same time that we were trying to manage what was going on in the Security Hospital, a number of other things were happening in our system. We settled the Jensen lawsuit, which you will hear more about in the coming weeks. That is a cost of about $2.5 million and regular ongoing costs associated with the court monitor. We had to make a number of critical upgrades to our health information system, or we would not meet what are called meaningful use requirements, like all other healthcare providers are required to do. We had to pay for these upgrades. We had a number of additional staff at Anoka Regional Treatment Center. We were getting close to the place where we are so understaffed and using overtime so much that we were not only exhausting our staff, but we were creating an unsafe work environment. And finally, you're familiar with the Karzgen's case, the sex offender lawsuit. You provided funds last session, but there are still ongoing litigation costs that weren't covered in the $3 million that was appropriated. Again, if you look at all of those things, you realize that we are trying to manage as many of these cost increases as we can. Already told you that we are holding on administrative positions throughout our system and doing everything we can to push support staff through. But the burden of all of these things together just got too much. That is why we're asking for the $10.4 million that is associated specifically with the changes in the Minnesota Security Hospital, because you can see specifically how that money got used. Which is included in the detail. The first thing we did was to add almost 60 security counselors. That's 58.55 security counselors. You can see the costs in both 14 and 15 of $8.2 million. And then with the second or the third condition on our license, you can see we had to add some additional clinical staff. And then to do the unscheduled observations, to create coaches and mentors, to do all the things that were added there, that's people with skills. We added another 18 staff for $1.2 million. Cameras were about $400,000, and then to remodel the unit was about $600,000. So all of those things add up to the $10.4 million that are included in the governor's deficiency request. And I would be happy to take questions if people have any of them about the detail.
Thank you, Commissioner. And there are other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you give us sort of an outline of what might happen if the legislature fails to allot the deficiency request that you've made here?
Commissioner Baer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we are running through a number of scenarios. As you know, people come to us through the courts and are committed to the commissioner through the court system. Not accepting a commitment puts the commissioner and others in the agency in jeopardy we've been ordered to show cause before, which is to stand in front of the judge and explain why we're not going to take a client. So standing in front of the court and explaining why we are not taking a client has its consequences. This would be more than one client. This is anybody who's currently at Security Hospital. There's a range of items that we're looking at, but again, that would mean maybe anyone who is voluntarily committed to us, we could no longer take. We don't do that at Security Hospital. We certainly don't do that in the Sex Offender Treatment Program. But then after that, the choices become much more difficult, like expediting a process for provisional discharges for clients who are currently in transition or pre-transition programs back to the counties so that they would have responsibility for them from the committing court. We currently are required by statute to take people from jails within 48 hours. We would, again, these all have consequences for the commissioner, and she's not sitting here describing them, but if we were to stop taking admissions from jail within 48 hours, there are consequences because it is legislation that you have passed and a requirement that we're trying to, and a commitment we're trying to meet. But at some point, we would have to stop taking admissions for our programs because we wouldn't have the money to serve people. By statute, we are required to continue payroll, but as you know, many of our staff are our physicians, some of our nurses and APRNs are contract staff. We could not keep them. And then we would come out of compliance with all of our licensing requirements. Almost any scenario doesn't look good for, it's either we find ourselves in contempt with the court for not committing people we're supposed to, or people stay in jail and we break the law. Those are all pretty serious consequences for the department and for all of us.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just I think so members get the full picture here, and I, you know, we do have some new members, and we're talking about people who are mentally ill and dangerous, right? So if we're talking about perhaps releasing people who are maybe in transition but not fully ready to be out back among us, we might be perhaps putting some of our, you know, putting our citizens at risk, possibly, right? Would that be accurate to say if we release people who really aren't perhaps ready to be released?
Commissioner Berry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, we would do everything we can to make sure that the placement in the community has the right level of supervision. It's where the burden of the cost falls in providing that kind of oversight and supervision. Counties aren't here right now in an inability to defend themselves against such an option on that we would forward, but much of the cost would fall back to counties and local units of government because they are who commit people to our programs if we are unable to do so and to provide those kind of community services. So again, the costs eventually fall somewhere in the system, and nobody wants to provide nobody wants to put either a community or a person who's getting ready to transition into the community in harm's way. So it's a question of where the cost would fall, and I think, again, it has pretty serious consequences.
Thank you, Ms. Berry, Ms. Olson, Mr. Kerber, for your testimony today and for the good work that you're doing there. One thing that I would just request for the deficiency request in the appropriation is just a breakout of what is ongoing versus what is one-time money within that, and also the 58.55 FTEs, how that breaks out and how it correlates to the other report that you have. If you could just one-page memo or something to Ms. Iverson, that would be great. We would greatly appreciate that. And with that, thank you again for your testimony and for the good work that you are doing. We look forward to your next testimony. And with that, members, we are adjourned.